Okay, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I had a massive quantity of written questions submitted to me. The only common denominator is that they pertain directly or indirectly to something which exists. Or at least which has been claimed to exist. And I just can't do that again for next Saturday. It took me hours and hours and hours just to read the questions that were submitted. So as of now, there is no more written questions for my question periods. I have weeded the ones that were submitted and tried to select the ones that I thought would be of general interest. There's a lot of questions from people who obviously do not know the basic materials of objectivism. Questions that either Ayn Rand wrote a whole book on or a specific long article or something like that. And to you people, I can only say you should really read Ayn Rand herself. That is the basic answer to all the questions. I can only hear address things taking that for granted. So if your question isn't answered, it doesn't mean that it isn't a good one. It probably means it's on a level that is too elementary to be of general interest, or in the other direction, so highly specialized that there would only be a small group of people that would be interested in it. I tried to follow this middle of the road path, but as I say, I can't take written questions hereafter. I did not dream that there would be such stacks and stacks and stacks of questions. And therefore, next Saturday, which is my second question period, is going to be entirely live from the floor. So if you have them, just think of them. You can write them down for your own benefit, but please don't show them to me. Now, I'm going to try and deal with this huge torrent of questions, or at least as many as I can get through. And occasionally, if I think of it, intersperse a live question now and again, just to get us used to the idea of live questions and wake you up periodically. I had a choice of taking a few and giving a detailed answer, taking many and giving brief and poor answers, and I decided to do the second. So I'm going to try to answer a lot of questions relatively briefly. I made a stab at an order and then gave up and then just threw them up in the air because it's impossible. So there's no order. Oh, as a matter of fact, the first question was this one. All right, let's just plunge in. This was given to me at dinner last night, so it got onto the top. What terms other than objectivism might have been used if they hadn't been preempted, and what are the deficiencies of these terms relative to objectivism? Well, thinking about it, actually, the single best word would have been rationalism. Because the ideal term would have had to come from the field of epistemology, which is really the essence of philosophy. And reason is the overall concept that summarizes the total epistemology. But, of course, rationalism has long been preempted. I think that would have been better than some metaphysical alternative, such as realism or existentialism, which would have focused on the primary metaphysical concept. But those, of course, have also, realism means dozens of things in philosophy, one of the most obvious being Plato's theory of concepts, so that's completely gone. The only other possible term could have been conceptualism, to stress the conceptual level of consciousness. But that is really too technical, it's almost too much a detail to make the name of an entire philosophy, and it also has been preempted for a particular theory of concepts. So. The only thing, actually, in thinking about it, that I would have preferred over objectivism is rationalism, but that was long gone. So objectivism, however, I'm very happy with. What is the difference between proving the impossibility of something and proving a negative, or proving that something does not exist? Proving the impossibility of something is a type of negative. In such a case, you're claiming not only that the thing does not exist, but that it cannot exist. It is impossible means the thing literally cannot ever exist. And the only way to prove that about something is to show that its existence would involve a contradiction. A round square is impossible and is provably so because the two attributes contradict each other. The idea of a creator of existence is exactly like a round square. It's something apart from existence, which then is a non-existence, so it can't have any attributes such as creating. And consequently, it's a direct self-contradiction. That's the direct answer to the question. I just hasten to add, even though these are supposed to be very brief answers which don't involve clarifying confusions that my brief answer might have entailed, you do not have to prove that something is impossible in order to dismiss it. There is no onus on you to prove a negative and no onus to prove that something is impossible. It's up to the advocate of it to prove that it is possible. If I say to you, arbitrarily, there's a Coca-Cola factory on Mars, you don't have to come up with some argument as to why that contradicts something we know. In other words, you don't have to show that it's impossible. You don't have to show that it doesn't exist. It's up to me to say that it does and to give you some basis. Otherwise, you just dismiss it on the grounds that the arbitrary is outside the realm of cognition. I'm going right on to the next question. Please distinguish between consciousness and awareness. Those are, generally speaking, synonyms. We use consciousness also to mean the faculty. But you can say, I am conscious of X, or I am aware of X. I don't know of any philosophic difference. I use the word conscious when I want an overtone of profundity and axiomatic quality, and aware when I just want to name the fact. I was aware that she was coming down the street. But there's nothing to necessitate that. And this person had one other, well, had, as a matter of fact, six other questions, but I'm only taking one other. And I'm picking and choosing among long questions, sometimes just excerpt. Basic axioms must be defined ostensively. And then he says, he can point to instances of existence, but how can he point to instances of awareness? What are the instances, and how do I show them to other people who have no access to my consciousness? Well, the point is they have access to their consciousness. They obviously can't perceive your awareness. They can only perceive their own awareness. What the instances are is every state of your awareness. Every time you see, hear, taste, touch, smell, feel, think, remember, imagine, fantasize, yearn, whatever it is, that is a form of awareness. And that primary state, therefore, is available to you as soon as you reach the stage of an infant of being able to set aside the content and turn in and focus on what you're doing. So you have countless instances, and the only way you can point it out to other people is tell them, turn in and do it themselves. And nobody has trouble with that except behaviorists. Now, not all the links, you'll forgive me if I'm condensing these long questions, but it's faster to reword them. Not all the links of your list on the blackboard in Lecture 2, remember existence, etc., are axiomatic. Hence, which of them are axioms and not merely metaphysical principles? And how do you distinguish between the two? Now, that is a question that would take a good chapter in a book of highly technical philosophy where you not only validate everything, but you step back and distinguish types of axioms, basic axioms from derivative axioms, and so on. I'll give you a quick answer. Existence, identity, and consciousness are all basic philosophic axioms. They are all axioms, even though identity and consciousness come later, because from an adult point of view of reconstructing human knowledge, every one of those three has to be assumed by everything you say and couldn't possibly be approached or derived from anything else without being assumed. Until you were, for instance, aware that A is A, you couldn't start any proof, ask any questions of validation as an adult, because validation is show the identity of a given thing. You first would have to know identity. So those three are certainly irreducible basic axioms. Entity is an axiomatic concept, that is to say, it's given directly from experience, All of our subsequent cognition is built on it, but for the reason I gave in the lecture and won't repeat, it is not a basic axiom. Causality is not an axiom at all. That is simply a corollary of the law of identity, an application of the law of identity to action. The primacy of existence is not an axiom. That is a corollary of the consciousness and existence axiom. That is, if you keep in mind, rather of all three axioms, if you keep in mind what that existence is, it is what it is, and therefore acts as it does, and that you have the faculty of being aware of it, that's what we've established up to that point, then to say that existence is independent of consciousness is simply a restatement of those earlier facts from the point of view of delimiting the power of consciousness. That is not a new or independent principle. Volition is trickier. I would define the state as this way. It's axiomatic in the sense that it is direct, ostensive fact. The capacity of your consciousness to make choices, specifically to focus or not, you can't get beneath that. You can't prove that. It's a precondition of all conceptual knowledge. But it is not a primary axiom in that you can show that it's a corollary of the axiom of consciousness. And I refer you to the literature for that. But in essence, if determinism were true, cognition would be impossible to a conceptual being, and that means we would be unconscious. And in that indirect way, you can show that volition doesn't have an independent status as an axiom. It's a corollary of consciousness. Now, I don't know, if you're asking questions on this level of technicality, the answer I gave is certainly much too short. So it's a choice of rattling off like that or ignoring it, and I thought it would be better to ignore it in that fashion. Now, here's a question about, wouldn't it be wrong to say that all concepts, including introspective concepts like thought, emotion, etc., can be reduced to perceptual concretes? I'm trying to condense this. In essence, what this questioner is asking is correct, and there's a misinterpretation. All concepts which represent integrations of physical external entities have to be reduced to the perceptual level. But concepts of consciousness obviously have to be reduced back to introspective data. The equivalent of the perceptual level with regard to concepts of consciousness is the internal data that you get when you directly look in. For instance, a toothache, a pain, a throbbing ache. There's no other way to reduce the concept pain than back to that's what I feel at this moment, etc. and so on for any sensations or any the very fact of awareness itself. So when we say reducing it to perceptual concretes, we're using perceptual there as meaning preconceptual awareness, but that leaves open whether it's outer through the physical senses or inner through direct introspection. Oh, this one, yeah. You claim that new knowledge can never contradict previous knowledge in your lectures, and you give the example of blood types. Now, this makes sense, etc., but take the example from the same lecture. I am now certain that you are Leonard Peacock. If those of you didn't take the lecture, I said, in answer to skeptics, I was explaining why you could be certain that it's me. And as part of the example, I went on to say, but just imagine it was something different. Suppose the mask suddenly fell off and you saw Boris Karloff. Well, then you would be certain that it was him. So he says, but this questioner says, if the mask did suddenly fall off, wouldn't this have contradicted my previous knowledge? And therefore, doesn't this refute your claim that new knowledge doesn't contradict old knowledge? So in other words, it comes down to this question. If you make a mistake, doesn't that your new conclusion contradict your old? Absolutely. There's no way out of that. No amount of epistemology or philosophy is going to make you infallible. And consequently, I said new knowledge can't contradict old knowledge. That doesn't mean that it can't contradict an old error. In order to be able to claim that, now of course then the next question you'll say is, well, but how do I know, since I haven't come up and actually pinched you, that you don't have a mask on right now, then maybe it just, you know, looks really convincing back there. To which I'd say, well, if you really have a basis to suspect that, wait till after the lecture and come over and touch, suspend judgment. The thing is this, to come to a conclusion, you have to have the proper method. You have to know what would be a validation, what kind of evidence is necessary to support that conclusion, and you have to be able to specify the context. You have to be able to say, this conclusion obtains within these circumstances. Now, if you're right on both of those, if you're okay on both of those, you delimit the context, and you apply the method, you have every grounds to say you're right, and barring mistakes, no later conclusion will contradict your earlier. As far as mistakes, that's possible at any time, but you can't believe it in any given case until you have a basis. So if someone says, how do you know you didn't commit a mistake? It's back to the onus of proof is on him. How do you know I did? What is your basis to think it? If you have any legitimate doubt, you can always say, what gave rise to the doubt? What is it based on? And it has to be based on something other than David Hume. Now, as you see, these are in no order. There's some personal ones interspersed, so I'll go to some of those. In regards to a biography of Miss Rand written, that would be written with your approval and support, what are the qualities of the biographer, other than honesty, that he's assuming that would be required, that you are looking for? For example, a person cites, would you require these four? That they've already written biographies. No, I would not require that. Age. Well, they have to have some age, but I wouldn't make that a... Schooling. No, I would not require that. And then this fourth one is the first. I thought about giving you a formal answer to this, and I came up with five operative criteria that I'm actually using. One is the one listed here by the questioner. A mind capable of appreciating and understanding a mind like Ms. Rand's. That is certainly a requirement. Someone that I think has the intelligence and the sensitivity to be able to appreciate it. You don't have to be an equal of her mind to appreciate it, obviously, or I would just scrap the whole project. But you have to be capable in some terms of understanding. And then I think very crucial to me is that a person is able to write clearly and eloquently. And it would have to be an accomplished writer, though not necessarily of biographies. I would want someone who does not have any trace of the defense mechanism of hostility. They don't have to be a picture of mental health, but I've been too disillusioned and disenchanted through the years by people who become hostile that I would want to know whatever problems the person has, that is not one of them. I would want someone who is committed to a lot of work because this is a complex and lengthy project, so they'd have to have the motivation to see it through. And frankly, I would want someone who would agree to let me edit the final thing because I'm not turning over all the documents until I'm sure that by my own personal judgment, justice has been done. So it would have to, in that way, be someone who would agree to work collaboratively. That's basically my criteria. Now, the next question, which I did put right with that one, when will there be a biography? When I find that person 3 to 5 years after that date. Now, this is, again, short or long. What remedial action must be taken to regain moral perfection after a conscious breach of morality is committed? To use your example of the embezzlement plan that you described to Miss Rand, I think I had a fake gold mine, if I remember. Suppose one deliberately carried it out and then changed his mind and atoned. What would you have to do to regain moral perfection? Well, it would obviously be utterly inadequate to say, sorry, I won't do it again. I would say that you would have to, first of all, attend to recompensing the victims, repaying the schemes, the money that they lost, the interest, etc. Secondly, if you were able to commit a breach of that dimension, you obviously have profound problems, and you would have to go to some kind of psychotherapist for a long time to understand what were the roots in your character or psychology and development that made that possible. And then you would have to uproot those roots, change your character, and you would certainly have to, you would see after a breach of that dimension, if you really did such a character change, you would find that it would not be only the virtue of honesty that you would change in. All the virtues are interconnected. And a person who truly reformed after such an act would be transformed ultimately across the board. And that would be a requirement for him properly to say, now I have regained or attained for the first time the proper moral status. This takes a long time, obviously. And until this kind of dramatic across-the-board change sustained across a long period is evident to other people, they have every right not to trust this person until they see the change. He in his own mind might be able to say after a week or a month or a year, well, I know I'm sincere. I know I have reformed and I'm really working to change, etc. But he has to be objective. He has to make his reformation so much a part of him for such a long period of time in so many contexts that people outside legitimately would say, the other guy is ancient history, he's dead, we now have a new person here. And I may say that I can never think of that having happened in my entire life. That is, of someone who committed a major, really major, I don't mean, you know, a lie or something like that, but a major continuous on the equivalent of the con man, I've never, ever seen such a person reform. I mean, theoretically, as long as they have free will, I suppose it's possible. It says, are you still planning a book on logic next? I never was planning a book on logic. So, are you planning a new course sometime soon? Yes, after I finish the book. Now, did you really give your permission for the use of the photos on the cover of James Baker's very odd book on Ayn Rand? Well, I guess the only way that I can function in life is just to say no to everybody on everything, and then there would be no misinterpretation. This gentleman wrote me far in advance that they're bringing out part of a scholarly series, that it was concerned with Ayn Rand's works, that it's part of this, they do every author live and dead, etc., for high school kids, that they were not interested in anything personal, just some factual biographical data and a synopsis and so on. And if I say so myself, he made some very intelligent comments about the ominous parallels, which made me think, well, this guy, you know, sounds pretty reasonable to me. No, but they were insightful. It wasn't just gushy and so on. I figured he wanted a picture. So I said, why not? You know, how can it hurt? So now, of course, he comes out with this book. I never saw another thing about it. I haven't read it, but I hear that it's full of all kinds of horrors. And everybody is busy now saying that I authorized it, I endorsed it, I cooperated. And all I did in a moment of weakness is give them the benefit of the doubt for being human, which I see as a mistake. But you know, you can't win, because if I had only talked to him on the phone, there would be an acknowledgement, you know, thanking him, me, for my conversation on the telephone, so I would lose either way. Now, this is a great question. I could give a whole seminar on, but I'll just do it in a minute instead. How would your current lectures have been different if your daughter had not been born? And a companion to that one is, should all philosophers have children? Well, I certainly wouldn't prescribe that all philosophers should have children. Obviously, Ayn Rand didn't have children, and she did pretty good without it. It certainly did help me. I could not have either written my book on the level that I'm doing it, or certainly given these lectures, the ones that pertain to hierarchy, in the form that I could without having had this unique experience of watching firsthand, step by step, this little consciousness ascend the conceptual structure, or at least develop from one cognitive level to the next. I was continuously surprised by the things that she put together and why and how it evolved. It was extremely helpful to me on many epistemological points. For instance, I would never have predicted in advance, since attributes and actions are both simply aspects of entities, I would never have known what is now blatant to me, that the consciousness can grasp actions far before colors, for instance, and that they know all kinds of activities way before they're able to grasp colors. I can see now when causality comes in, when entity comes in. You could actually read the development, and it has a concrete reality. If those of you remember when I discussed hierarchy in my 76 course, I said, imagine presenting a concept to your pet. And imagine the steps you would, I think we took friendship, I said, imagine the steps that you would have to go through to bring it down to the level the pet could grasp. But that was a pretty theoretical exercise, because you can't do it to a pet, but you actually can start to do it to a child. And it's extremely, extremely illuminating to me to see what links are obvious when I didn't expect they would be, and what links are difficult when I didn't expect they would be. And I began to acquire a much, much more detailed sense of the hierarchical structure of cognition, the process of concept formation, the contextual nature of concept formation. There was a stage, just to take one tiny example, but this perhaps concretizes what I mean. My daughter at one stage used the word UP to stand interchangeably for pick me up, airplane, and bird. And she called them all up. And you know, this was to me was fascinating, because it was an example of a primitive concept formation. She didn't exactly have the direction. She had the idea of something going like this, but she was confused between the process of moving up there, the relationship of being above the entity, or which entity. And she started with that very big generality, which is exactly on the order of Ayn Rand's example of man as a, what was it, a thing that moves and makes noises. And then I saw her specify it as she went. There were countless examples of things like that that really made both the contextual nature of concept formation and the hierarchical structure of concepts tremendously more real to me. Now, I assume that as she grows older, ethics will also undergo such a development in my mind when I see the problems as they arise. But so far, we're just working with concepts. Now, I've always regarded it to be within the realm of rational, selfish action to be casually friendly to and spend time talking with people who share some but not all of my values. For example, I have a delimited friendship with a colleague whose work is excellent, although her politics are fairly leftist. It has been argued to me that such social interactions are unselfish because an individual's time is precious and should only be diverted from productive work to spend time with people who are a perfect reflection of his own value. Well, that is fantastic. Completely wrong. A perfect reflection of your own values, I don't even know what exactly you mean by perfect here, but that would at best be the definition of getting married. But you're talking here about spending some time with people. And there, the question is only, do they represent some values of yours that you legitimately hold, and do you get some pleasure out of the interaction? What kind of attributes do they have that you like? And if this particular colleague is an effective and hard worker and so on, and you talk to them about the movies or talk to her about going fishing or whatever it happens to be, that is absolutely 1,000% legitimate. The question is to say, your time is precious and shouldn't be diverted from productive work. Where was it written that you're supposed to engage in productive work for 24 hours a day? I mean, if like me, 6 hours of productive work a day is the tops. Now, other professions maybe can do more, but that's about all I can do, what I call productive, completely focused work. So a lot of life is just fooling around. So it depends. What are your choices? What are your alternatives? There's a perfectly legitimate, valid desire for social relations, and even for a whole range of social relations. There are certain things, people that you go to a hockey game with that are not a perfect reflection of your values, that you would never marry, but you'd rather spend time with them than the person who is a perfect reflection of your values. So this is an intrinsicist interpretation of objectivism. Like, there is a commandment, thou must work. And then two, thou must seek out, values without any idea of the context of actual reality. Now then the questioner goes on, another side of the argument is whether integrity demands that one does not sanction those who are not consistently moral. My opponent contends that Rourke's friendship with Winand was wrong, was unselfish. Because the argument simply, apparently, is if you have integrity, the person has to be consistently moral, and Winand, according to this, was not moral, and therefore Rourke didn't have integrity. Well, you can make up anything you want, but this is beyond the pale of what you can make up. What do you mean by consistently moral? What is the scope and nature of the moral breach? You certainly can't be friendship with somebody who is immoral in some significant, volitional, adult way. But when you are, because a person who is immoral on that kind of level is someone who is subverting all of the principles of proper human behavior, who's waging a significant war against reality. And if you hold objective or rational values, you won't have much community with such a person. But Winand is not such an example. Winand is a person who made a very fundamental and tragic metaphysical error in his early years in the process of character formation. It's an open question to me, at least, I can't speak for the author, she's not here, whether it was a pure error of knowledge or there was also a volitional element when he was young. It could have been a volitional element because she suggested a certain impatience, an unwillingness to accept the dolts around him, which could become a kind of a willful self-indulgence. He's just going to brush it aside without having the endurance necessary to survive in this kind of world. So there might have been implied a volitional element, and it might have been just that it was a complete error. In either case, it was something long, long ago committed. He did not have any way of knowing it. As an adult, what this came from, he was living his life. He was the expression of trying to live with all the energy and fervor and enthusiasm at his command within the framework of a crippling error. And I think that his fundamental honesty was in the fact that when he finally was confronted with the evidence, he avowed that he had wasted his life. He didn't try to destroy Rourke. He, in effect, admitted his error, and therefore he is an example of a tragic hero. He is certainly not the example of an immoral man. If you're talking immoral man as Ellsworth Toohey or James Taggart, etc., a man whose character is as noble as Winand is certainly not properly described as immoral. And the idea that Rourke was unselfish to have pleasure dealing with a man such as Winand is fantastic. any decent person go to the ends of the earth to find somebody like one and just to talk to him for a day? Well, I would certainly travel to Tahiti for that, and it would not be selflessness. There's more on that, but I'm going on too long here. Now, this is a long argument, but this one, maybe you recognize it, whoever wrote it. But it comes down to, you say that if we were indestructible and didn't have to act to support ourselves, there would be no values possible. And I gave the example of the indestructible robot. But, now I'll quote the very end of this long thing, I don't see why enjoyment of music or playing games, what that has to do with sustaining my life. If I became immortal, why would I stop enjoying these things? So I'll just take his two examples, because he's taking as a primary. You see, the idea is, why couldn't an immortal, indestructible robot listen to Beethoven and play chess and get, you know, a lot of pleasure out of both of those, even though he doesn't have to take any action to sustain himself? And doesn't that therefore refute the view that all values have life at their root? And the answer is no, it does not, because both of those values also have the alternative of life or death at their root and would not be possible to an immortal, indestructible being. Music is a form of art. If you know the objectivist view of art, you know that it's man has a need of art and therefore an ability to respond to art only because he has a need of a certain kind of guidance. He has to act. To act, he needs long-range philosophic guidance, but he can't retain his view of the world purely in abstract philosophic terms. He needs to have it concretized and held in the forefront of his consciousness. And it's that practical, life-related need that art fulfills. It being that was utterly indestructible, would have no reason in the world to need cognition, nor philosophy, nor a view of life, nor a view of anything, nor therefore any concretization of it. And the whole realm of art would be completely nil to such a being. Art is a need only of a conceptual mortal. As far as games are concerned, games are enjoyable only because they represent a state of rest and relaxation in the context of struggle, effort, work, production. But if you take away the need of that, because you take away the alternative of life or death, you take away the basis for games, amusement, and so on. And thus you see quickly the spectacle of people who get tremendously bored just with games and amusement because they are only peripheral. They're only within the context of a being that has to work. And that is true if you work it out for every other value that seems to be self-evident. Now, here's a variant of a question we just took. I get this type of question many times. I never exactly understand it, but maybe I can finally hit this. If Gail Winand and Andrei Taganov were exceptionally intelligent, why did they choose not to change? That is, why didn't Winand choose to close down his paper during that crucial meeting? And I've had this asked to me about all of the characters who are other than the pure villain or the hero. And the answer is really very simple, I guess. They hadn't read the book. I mean, to me, this is exactly the same as, why don't you give Winand the Fountainhead to read? It would change his mind. He'd see his mistake. You couldn't write the book then. The idea of this is to show, given a certain premise, how a person will act. You, the reader on the outside, are learning something about his choices, his alternatives, his mistakes, but he is living it. He is, if you would stop any process of fictionalizing or of dramatizing if you injected a lecture. Someone once asked me, why didn't Rourke, since he wanted to have a girlfriend that he really admired, tell Dominique objectivism early in the fountainhead. Well, that, or send her to Peikoff's lectures. I mean, if you follow this, you'd have to say there should not be any fiction. People should just read books on philosophy. All errors should be corrected. Now, oh, I'm saving this because I have two on AIDS, so I'll put that with the one on AIDS if I find it. That is not with, but on AIDS. Here is two questions, and I had several like this, so I'll take a second more on this. As I understand the primacy of existence, one aspect of it is that consciousness cannot influence or change a material object. But what about when I get an ulcer? Isn't that a change brought about merely by an act of consciousness? And I had, oh, three or four. Here's this one other I saved, and it was, how can you explain, let me find, how a baby can move his hand directly toward a ball? Isn't that, you wouldn't have to say just a baby, an adult. I mean, look, here's the primacy of consciousness then, because I had a desire and this glass rose up in the air. So how do I explain this if existence is independent? I explain it by the fact that you've changed the topic on me. Mind and body form in each person a single unity, a living organism. When we talk about consciousness, we are abstracting an attribute away from a single living organism. Consciousness is like vision. It's the power of sight, the power of grasping something. It's an attribute of a total entity. And because mind and body are integrated, every process of consciousness has a physical component to it. There's nothing unique about an ulcer or raising your arm. Every process of consciousness, because it's simply an attribute of a total entity, also has inextricably a physical component. An obvious example is you feel fear. That's an emotion. And there's all kinds of physical states and processes, you know, from the sweating palms and the pounding heart and so on, that are an intrinsic aspect of it. Consciousness is not some kind of disembodied faculty. It's built into a physical organism. The same is true of every process of thought. Even the purest emotionless thought has every kind of brain wave and electron switching and twitching, etc. I mean, you know that perfectly well. So, when you talk about the relation of consciousness to external reality, that is an entirely different thing, you are saying. Leaving aside the body of this possessor that possesses this consciousness, thinking of it just as a faculty of awareness, what can it do to its object? Obviously, there all it can do is focus on them. But there is a completely different relationship between my consciousness and my arm and my consciousness and your arm. I can't do a thing by wishing about your arm. Mine is much more intimately connected, I should hope. Now, even here, the primacy of existence has application even to your own body in many obvious ways. For instance, I could wish I was 6 feet 4 inches tall, as that my consciousness has an intimate connection to my body, but I'm stumped. I can't do that. I could wish I could jump back to the room afterwards so I wouldn't have to walk to the car, but I can't do that. So that there are many limitations. And entities still have their identity, but it happens to be a fact of reality that within definite ways and context, following the laws of nature, your mind has certain effects on the body and vice versa. That is in no way in conflict with the primacy of existence. I asked that question, in case I sound indignant, I asked that question to Ms. Rand about 30 years ago. And she gave me a much longer and more indignant answer, so for what it's worth. Ayn Rand obviously mastered the English language, yet she always retained a Russian accent. Why? And then the person goes on to hypothesize various reasons, but the answer to that is she did not like her accent. One of the person's hypotheses is that her husband personally asked her to retain her accent. That is utterly wrong, utterly wrong. She did not like her accent, but when you become an adult, it's extremely difficult to change. If she had chosen acting as her career, she would have done it. And she would have spent the incredible painstaking time it required, but it just was not worth it to her. She was not a professional speaker, and she did not want to divert the time from what she considered more important. But she did make a deliberate effort on certain words, which cost her tremendous difficulty, like the word think, which tended in Russian to come out as sink. And with objectivism, think is a very big word. And I saw how hard she worked to learn to say the th in think. I mean, if you knew the problems that changing accents, you would say either she has to learn to speak English perfectly or write her novels. And I'm glad she chose the latter. This one I will share with you without comment. This was given on the day we had the picture taken. Was this afternoon's photo session an example of the mind-body split? Namely, separation of the rational faculty and the student body. All right, how could Oliver North be a man of principle, as Peter Schwartz says, if he trades weapons to Iran and he lists all kinds of other bad things? to answer that one briefly, because we're going to be discussing the topic of principle next week, I don't believe that Peter Schwartz meant to suggest that Oliver North was an objectivist or that he subscribed to every proper principle, or even to a system of principles. He was taking him as an example of a man who had one firm principle, only one, but that was enough to wipe out the whole committee and enlist the passion of the whole country. He did not apologize for being against communism, and that was a principle. He was opposed to it in every instance as an absolute, and he said, in effect, fry me in hell, I don't apologize for it. And in that way, for the reasons as Peter indicated, he made a tremendous effect on the country. But the problem with people like North, good as they are, is precisely that they do not have a whole system of principles. They're not principled on principle. They happen to attach to a given principle, you know, if they're decent and they're honest, but they don't have a whole moral political code. They don't have a whole philosophy of principles. And that is why ultimately people like that, however well-meaning, cannot achieve their single out-of-context principles. That's even why they would agree to undertake assignments such as this. I mean, imagine that the horribleness of being put in a position where one branch of government tells you it's illegal to fight communism. The other one says, fight it, but I don't want to know anything about it because it'll get me in trouble. And now you've got to go and fight it behind the scenes while one doesn't want to know and the other's ready to arrest you for doing it. Now, to me, if I were given that assignment and if I had any public voice, the first thing I would do is resign and I would announce to the country it is impossible to save this country from communism because the two branches of government are debating over who will cause more difficulty in defending the country and who will make it easier for the communists to take over. And I'd give chapter and verse, cause a tremendous scandal and never be heard of again. But you see, the problem is that people who have one or two out of context principles think you can be pragmatic in implementing them, and then they're exposed there's no real upshot to it, no long-lasting value. I understand that North is religious, apparently very religious. And if that's true, that would help to explain why he doesn't have a full philosophy. Now, a big jump from that to metaphysics. Please explain how philosophy can validate facts prior to the formation of logic and the scientific method. Well, I thought I did explain that. You get your basic facts by direct observation. Your validation is open your eyes. How do I know that there are things, that anything exists? I open my eyes and look. How do I know that there are entities? I see them. How do I know that I'm aware? I introspect and I just observe my awareness. There's a whole catalog, the whole entire perceptual level, and everything implicit in it is given by direct observation. And consequently, you'd be in a tremendous circle if you say you have to have logic to validate facts. Where do you get the facts that lead you to such a complex development as logic? So you can't, out of context, make a proposition like this. Nothing is a fact unless science has proved it. That is ridiculous. Science is a specialized, high-level form of cognition, which presupposes a whole foundation, including, like every other subject, the direct observation of reality, a proper metaphysics, and all the steps of concept formation. Only then can you say, when I'm dealing in a specialized knowledge situation, then I need to use a specialized method and I'll work on it in astronomy or physics or psychology or whatever it happens to be. But at the beginning, you don't have a method. You got to get to the stage where you have a method. If emotions are not tools of cognition, I'm not even one half through this pile yet, and I haven't taken any oral questions. But I'll just keep going. If emotions are not tools of cognition, should they be utterly ignored when forming conclusions? No, they should not be utterly ignored. I refer this question to my course on Understanding Objectivism, where I have good part of one entire lecture on the role of emotions in human consciousness, including in the acquisition of knowledge. And a simple example would be, for example, in judging people. You can very often are given invaluable clues about another person simply by your emotional reaction. You just feel, I don't like that guy. He rubs me the wrong way. There's something about him I don't like. Now, you may not be able at that point to put your finger on it. It's very difficult to identify your emotions sometimes about people. And you may have to collect evidence slowly, gradually, and maybe only years later say, well, it was this and this and this about him that gave me that opinion. And you may find you were wrong. You may realize that when you know the person better, you misinterpreted something. But nevertheless, the first step is to know that you have some kind of reaction and take it under advisement. To make it a tool of cognition would mean you just follow it automatically. If you take a dislike to someone, he's evil. If you take a liking to someone, he's wonderful. That would be using it as a tool of cognition. But if you say, I'm responding to something, I don't necessarily say that it's infallible, but I'd like to know what it is, and then I will appraise it rationally, that is indispensable. In fact, this applies to much more than merely judging people. I have had this experience writing philosophy. The most abstruse, academic, esoteric level, and I'll read it, and it makes me feel anxious. And I have no idea why. Intellectually, it's perfectly clear as far as I can make out. It's step by step and so on, and I get an uneasy feeling. This is talking about my own writing. I get an uneasy feeling. There's something, I don't know. I can't, just can't. It's exactly what you have when you meet someone that rubs you the wrong way and you don't know why. And if I were deprived of those inner feelings, I couldn't write at all. Because I want to be finally know the passage is right. It has to fulfill every intellectual test that I have, and I have a great many. And on top of that, when I read it, I have to feel that is terrific. But I have to feel that over and above all the tests. Otherwise, I keep at it until I say, what is it that's bothering me? So in that sense, emotions are invaluable, but they're merely leads. They're indications of something to be found out. They're not answers. Now, there's a question that I respect, but which I don't know how to answer briefly. It amounts to, when someone takes the devil's advocate approach with you during a discussion, how do you know whether he's sincere or just deliberately being a pain in the neck? They put it differently, but that's what it amounts to. And the only device that I know to answer that is ask the person directly, why do you ask that? Do you really believe what you are saying here? Are you doing that to bait me? Are you doing that because you're actually puzzled? If so, what puzzles you? Because I don't follow what is unclear. Do you really believe that? If so, what is your basis for believing that? And if you do that a couple of times, usually they'll get the message that you won't put up with, you know, heckling as an end in itself. And then if they have a real issue, they'll go to the issue. And if they don't, you'll terminate the conversation. But in other words, don't assume that you have to answer a question just because it's asked you. You're always free to look at, you know, you can even do this politely if you had enough to drink. You could just look, you know, just say, why do you ask that? I'm curious to know. And that very often will turn the tables because the person doesn't know why he asked that. Now, here is a question which, oh, I guess I have to answer it. Is the confiscation of kiddie porn and snuff films a form of censorship? My answer to that would be the confiscation of those materials is legitimate. I regard the production of such films as being the accessory to a crime and consequently as not having any rights to circulation. Now, a crime, if you know objectivism, is something that has to be defined in physical terms. Snuff films are not recreations of murder. They are movies of an actual murder. So, you know, if you act a gory murder on the movies, that's not a snuff film. Kiddie porn, I classify under the physical maltreatment of children. I regard it, one instance of it, as sufficient to justify the child being taken permanently from the parents losing all rights to the child thereafter, permanently. You see, I do believe the state can't interfere on philosophic, psychological issues. If wrong as the parent is, it's his child. But the state can interfere. If you turn your child into a prostitute or a sodomite or whichever, and whether they're taking pictures or not, you are subjecting that child to a horrific physical abuse. And it's exactly parallel to if you are a sadist and you beat your child. I think all of that should be defined as a crime in the law and should require the parent to lose all rights to the child. Now, because these two things, in my judgment, are physical crimes, they can nothing, anybody that has any traffic or commerce with them, that photographs them, that sells the movies and so on, is an accessory to a crime and should be subject to criminal penalty, in my view. This is not an issue of censorship. If adults on a voluntary basis want to do whatever they want with each other's bodies and film it and revel in it, I don't care. But as long as it's a child, the parents have absolutely no right to do it, and the state has every right to prevent it. Even adults, I think there's a point at which you could, but I don't want to, you know, go into the hassles that would be involved in writing a whole criminal statute on the subject. But for instance, suppose adults decided to film a movie of torture for an SM audience, and the torture was really graphic and real, and they were cutting off one limb at a time, you know, at a certain point, and before that point, I think that has become a crime of mutilating another human being. And the government cannot take cognizance or permit crimes, even if the parties voluntarily agree to it. If you give me $100 and say, lock me up for life, the government, no one, neither you nor your heirs or friends can come and say, Peikoff didn't live up to his promise, so you have to penalize him. You cannot, in a proper society, make a contract and expect the government to enforce a crime. By the same token, you can't expect it to ignore a crime or to allow accessories to a crime to flourish. So from this point of view, if you remember that crime has to be defined in physical terms, I am absolutely not a libertarian. Let's let anybody do whatever they want, you know, and we think is wonderful. I don't believe that. I'll take your approval under advisement. Thank you. Is emotional repression, you see, we're jumping so hard from one to the other here that it's hard to disorient myself. Is emotional repression a form of evasion? And if so, is it immoral? No and no. Emotional repression is an automatized avoidance of an emotional reaction where you come not to know that you experience it. It has a thousand possible different motives, and it can be, although it needn't always be, it can be 100% honest, and in fact, it can be courageous in many cases. Person may feel a great deal of fear. They don't know why or where it came from, but they know they have to function. They can't do anything about it, and so they take the attitude, I'm just going to, they don't do it consciously, but what it amounts to is they just brush that aside, and they're going to continue to focus on reality and try and achieve their goals despite the fear. And the fear becomes simply an inexplicable enemy not to be focused on. That can be a perfectly heroic a motive. The person does not want to be stopped by fear, and they don't know what to do with it, and it becomes a complete repression. So now, of course, there can be also very ignoble motives, but you have to be very careful. Evasion is a deliberate volitional policy in the moment that you're doing it. You have to have the knowledge of what you're doing, or at least have the ability to know in that moment what you're doing and that you should be doing something else, that you are willfully looking away. That is, you shouldn't be bothered by, am I evading when I don't know it? If you don't catch yourself in the process, you're not doing it. Evasion is not a subtle, tricky, indirect psychological process that sneaks up on you. So if you have to ask, the answer is no, I'm not doing it. Now, this next question, I just simply have to challenge the premise. If nobody in a free society would help orphans, would you let them starve? And I haven't heard that for 20 years. If that were the situation in a free society, there would be no free society. If people were at that stage of malevolence, that a perfectly innocent young orphan, they'd say, let them starve, they would have hated each other for so long in so many ways, and for such profound philosophic corruption underlying it, that they would long since have become a dictatorship. So I wouldn't even grant the reality to this premise. The most you could possibly say is if some young orphan left out in a wilderness somewhere that no one, you know, found out about, and has no access to organized society, and then his parents die, what should be done about it? Well, try and find him is what I would say. Organize a hunting party. Don't start a welfare bureau. Ayn Rand wrote that all that which is proper to the life of a rational being is the good. Isn't this circular since proper means good? It does not mean good. First of all, there are two different words. They have two different contexts, and proper in this case is a purely factual term. It's synonymous with appropriate, suitable, befitting, or consistent with. Proper to the life of that which is proper to the life of a rational being means that which is in harmony with, advances, sustains, makes possible the living of such a life. So it certainly is not a way of saying all that which is good is good. That would be ridiculous. It's saying our standard is keeping this type of creature alive. Whatever does that is the good. Now, you say, why didn't she word this differently? Believe me, I've had a little experience in this. There is no, the way she once put it to me is, something can be foolproof, but nothing can be damn foolproof. Do I have another philosophic as distinct from? Yeah.
I just wanted to ask if there are some things that you said that you subscribed to in the past that you changed your mind on.
Everybody wants to know, what are things that you did wrong in the past that you're right about now? Oh, I could give you a whole litany. In fact, I did several in the lecture, but I'll tell you one really gross error that's on one of the tapes. I applied the objective, subjective, and intrinsic trichotomy to sense perception. I took the view that sense experience was objective, this was many years ago, as opposed to being intrinsic or subjective, and tried to develop a whole thing around that, which is completely wrong because the concept of objectivity only arises on the conceptual level. There's no choice and there's no method with regard to sense percepts, they're just a given. And that was thoroughly confusing. That must have cost me 3 years of mental development, just that one error. And as I remember, Ayn Rand casually said, you know, that wasn't too clear because you made it sound as though sense perceptions are objective. I said, well, what do you mean? So if you feel better, I could make you feel really great by telling you my history. All right, let me go back to my pile here. Here, I just picked up one at random. Ayn Rand mentioned that morality ends at the point of a gun. Does this mean that a criminal loses his rights? Yes. As soon as a man initiates the act of force, he is outside the principle of rights and cannot claim them anymore. He becomes like a wild animal. So if you incarcerate him, you are not violating his right to liberty. And if you execute him, you are not violating his right to life. Rights are contextual. They apply within the context of a rational being. A being who resorts to force is outside that context. According to objectivism, are there any morally neutral acts? Well, if I understand you, yes. Look. I scratch my nose. Would you say terrific or awful? Good, evil, optional act that has no moral significance. Now, I can think of contexts in which you should scratch it, you know, if it's bothering you, and you are deliberately trying to be an ascetic, you know, and torture yourself in order to gain God's favor, and you sit there with this scratch and you just suffer it, I think that's wrong. You made a wrong choice. Morality mandates that you scratch it. And I can think of contexts in which you have a sore and the doctor tells you if you scratch it, it's going to get infected. You just have to grin and bear it. And you say to hell with it and scratch it, and that's an act of evasion and self-indulgence, and it's wrong. So within a given context, any act can acquire significance. And the principles on which you act always are right or wrong. But there are many acts within the basic principles that are entirely optional. If that's what you mean by morally neutral, then certainly there's all kinds of morally neutral acts. Now, how does one sort out the intrinsicists versus the pragmatists? I would have placed Reagan in with the religionists without Mr. Schwartz's guidance. How do you explain this? Well, I think Reagan is the perfect synthesis of both. He's an intrinsicist and subjectivist, or a religionist and a pragmatist at the same time, as far as I can make out. I think his union of the two is he's got revelations that he believes are revelations, that he clings to firmly, at least in his speeches, you know, the whole moral majority side. And at the same time, he has to function in reality, and those revelations offer him no guidance. So in practical terms, he's a complete pragmatist. And it's not at all uncommon to combine religion and pragmatism. And here I remind you of the fact that you can't follow an error consistently, and the point that we made in the lecture, that intrinsicism always goes over to subjectivism and vice versa. And for more details, I would suggest you read from The Ominous Parallels the part on dogmatism and pragmatism. Specifically that on the Nazis, how they combined being zealous, dogmatic, fervent religionists with being complete Machiavellian, diabolical pragmatists. And I tried to show in detail that there was no inconsistency there. And I think Reagan is a mild version of that. He's the worst of both worlds. Now, that's the one I just answered. Why doesn't the view that knowledge is contextual apply to the fundamental metaphysical ideas you presented, such as causality or the primacy of existence? I'm rewording it, but that's what it amounts to. In other words, why shouldn't you say, A is A within the context of my present knowledge? But how do I know what scientists are going to discover tomorrow that'll, you know, make me amend my knowledge? The answer to that is that philosophic axioms and principles are the precondition of all knowledge, including scientific knowledge. You cannot have scientific knowledge. You can't practice science until you have a metaphysical and epistemological foundation. So it would be logically impossible to discover, using scientific means, an invalidation of your foundation. If you did, it would pull down your science at the same time. And that would be the end. So there are many things that you have to specify and say within the present context. You do not have to say that about basic principles of philosophy. Did Ayn Rand intend the character of Dominique Francon to be an ideal woman, in other words, a model to be admired and emulated, or as a warning of what a fundamental error can do to an only potentially ideal woman? Well, if you're talking about her at the beginning of the book, and if I understand you, clearly she meant the latter. In other words, she thought that Dominique was wrong, if that's what you're asking. There was a clash between Rourke and Dominique throughout the book, where Rourke represented the benevolent and Dominique the malevolent view of the universe. And he tried to show her that she ascribed too much power to people, to their evil and to their irrationality, and that her values were not threatened by them. And finally, she came around to seeing it. So if you mean Dominique qua embodiment of an error, certainly that was not something to be emulated. What are the next posthumous books by Ayn Rand to be published? And when? The next, meaning I assume the next couple. The one that is presently now under consideration that I believe is going to be next is an anthology of the complete Ford Hall from the beginning right up to the end, culminating in my recent one, which is the memoir of her. Because we have that available, and many of those Ford Hall talks have not come out. So it's interesting, I think, to watch the whole progression from 1961 right on through, and you see the same principles applied to the different succeeding administrations and generations right on, you know, from Nixon way back there and Johnson and so on. I believe that's next. As far as the material that you wouldn't yet have had access to, the first three on my list are Harry Binswanger is working on an edited version of her lectures on fiction writing, Peter Schwartz on an edited version of her lectures on nonfiction writing, and as soon as I finish my book, I want personally to edit her journals. And those are the next three that are going to come out. Then only after that do we get to things like letters and so on. But you're talking here a long time. And then there's a question to the effect of, if Kant wrote so poorly as you say, why were his ideas so easily spread? Because he concealed in coils of jargon all of his alleged validation of his ideas. But he was crystal clear on the essence that he was communicating. Anybody, even a PhD, can get the message of what he stood for. It's a different question of how he claimed to prove it. Now, listen to this one. I couldn't resist this. Here's an argument offered by someone. I am a human being. Certain cultural requirements must be met in order for me to survive, such as a free capitalistic economic system, a non-religious environment, no churches, etc. In effect, I'm still reading, those conditions outlined by the objectivist philosophy. Next premise. The cultural requirements for my survival have not been met, do not currently exist. Therefore, conclusion, I cannot survive. Question, what is keeping me alive? In other words, this is now a formal deductive proof that he must be dead. I'm a human being. Certain requirements are necessary to keep me alive. Those requirements haven't been met, so I'm dead. I'm obviously not dead, so there's a problem here. Now, who would want to put their finger on what the problem is here? Let us grant the premise, this is a human being, he's alive. Two, certain requirements have to be met. Okay, absolutely true. Now, I just have to mention in regard to that the absence of churches is not such a requirement. The only social requirement is that you be left free. People can build as many churches as they want. That does not affect your survival. So that's a misstatement. But leaving that aside, let us say he's alive and certain requirements are necessary. And those requirements are not met. Now, how come he's still alive?
Yes.
Well, you say he's dying, but he looks healthy, hale, fit. Somebody back, yes.
Equivocation on the word requirement.
Well, what's the equivocation on requirement?
It says physical requirements versus spiritual requirements.
Well, you could look at it that way. I would say short-term versus long-term. Also physical and spiritual, but it depends on this. Certain requirements are such that if they're violated for even the shortest span of time, you're dead. You know, if you take the requirement for oxygen, you have a very, very short span. You have more for food, for instance, but not, you know, a couple years without it. So at one point is, how long range is the requirement? Another point is, how fully is it being violated? If you're given a little dribble of nourishment, you can eke out a lot longer than if it's cut off completely. In the same way that you can survive much longer in a mixed economy than you can in a totalitarian one. So it is the case that in the long run, ultimately, if you violate the philosophy human life requires, you'll die. But that doesn't mean midway through the process, as things are falling apart, so long as you're still getting some of the nourishment, spiritual, political, physical that you need, you're going to die immediately. If that were true, life would be very easy because it'd only be two kinds of people, good and dead. The trouble is it takes a long time for the non-good to disappear. I don't have time for this one. And I think I already answered that one. I want to get to that. Well, some of these I'm going to save for next time. Well, I may as well mention AIDS, because I said I would, and I just found it. What should the government do about AIDS? Well, I don't know that the government should do anything about it. The primary requirement with regard to AIDS is research, scientific medical research, to find out what the cause is and to find a proper cure. And that is a scientific medical question. Now, you all know, or you should know, that I obviously believe this would be done much more effectively and much more quickly in a private setting by private researchers than with a huge government bureaucracy. So I think the government is slowing things down and wrecking the whole medical establishment, including research, by its interference in the with the practice of medicine and the research into medicine. However, I would not, of all the things, I would not go on a campaign to tell them they shouldn't fund AIDS research. You know, there's a lot of other things I would fight first. Although in principle, it would be much faster to find a cure if we had free medicine and free scientists. Beyond that, it becomes then a question of what are the people suffering from AIDS posing a physical threat to others? As far as I know, now I'm speaking here as a newspaper reader with no medical training, there is no risk except in situations where you are voluntarily in control. That is, apparently it can't be transmitted by casual contact. I don't know this of my own knowledge, but as far as I can make out. If that's the case, I see no grounds whatever to quarantine AIDS patients. If they were injecting some kind of material from their bodies involuntarily into yours, then of course they should be quarantined if you had no way of defending yourself. That would be just protecting yourself from physical assault. But if the situation is as the New York Times claims it is, with all the experts that they interview, that there is no such threat, then the only way they can get to you is through sexual intercourse, let us say, or sharing hypodermic drugs with them. And in those cases, you are doing something deliberately and volitionally, so they're not forcing it on you. The one exception I would make is this. I definitely do believe that if an individual has AIDS, knows it, and withholds that information from a partner, he should be subject, and the partner asked, and if the partner asked, he should be subject to prosecution for murder. I definitely believe that that is a premeditated use of a deadly weapon. It's a form of assault, and it can be lethal. And in fact, there are cases in the courts where people are being tried for murder for precisely, I don't know if they call it murder or, you know, there's 12 different legal terms depending upon what state and so on. But I definitely think that should be a crime. But now, if it happens to you in an orgy, it's not. Because it's the conditions. You went in there, you don't care who you sleep with, good luck. But if you seriously ask the person, and you have every reason to believe them, and they do it as an act of, why shouldn't you go along with me, I definitely think that's a crime. But I don't know if that's what the question means by how should the government deal with AIDS. That's the only conjunctions that I can think of the government being involved with. And that brings me to this last question on AIDS. It seems to me that not only the promiscuous today are in jeopardy. I have heard that one must be, he or she goes into the test conditions, but part I wanted to get to is, before AIDS, the past life of a mate lover was none of my business, but now, what? I get the feeling that there are attractive time bombs walking around. Please comment in terms of the conduct becoming a single heterosexual person who now finds AIDS added to life. Well, I sympathize with this question. I think it is a dreadful development. It is apparently applicable. You can get it through heterosexual, although not as frequently as homosexual. And there are completely innocent victims of it, including from blood transfusion, who may not even know that they haven't, may never even dream that the transfusion they had 5 years ago, 10 years from now, is going to lead to AIDS or that they're infecting someone else. Now, in New York City, so I understand, they deal with this problem very forthrightly. They take each other's sexual, social transfusion history before they go out on dates. And it's casual, you know, the way on a blind date, in the old days you used to ask, what do you do, and so on, you know, just to say hello. It's not, you know, how long since the last, and who was it, and how many, and when did you last have a transfusion, and do you take drugs, and et cetera, and so on. Now that is, I wouldn't do that, but it, to me, that's better than going completely blind if you're in a context where this type of thing is a possibility. The ultimate, now they say, of course, using condoms is some protection, so you can certainly avail yourself of that, but different experts say different things. Every time four of them say that makes it safe, a fifth one will come up with cases where it isn't, so apparently it's not 100%. The ultimate thing comes down to this. You have to know who you're sleeping with. You have to know the character of the person enough so that if they then tell you, I'm clean, and they know what the possible sources of risk would be, you can believe them. That is not foolproof because they may be misled, but it's simply another indication of what objectivism has argued for on philosophic grounds for a long time, that sex should not be casual. It should be based on a knowledge and a mutual value affinity with the other person of very important and serious values. And surely one of those values should be tremendous respect for the integrity and honesty of the other person. So I would say, as a rule of thumb, if you are not sure your partner is telling you the truth, that in and of itself should stop you from sleeping with them, let alone because they might communicate AIDS to you. But still, and all, having said all that, there are undoubtedly tragic cases, which I really deeply sympathize with, the people, because it's really difficult to judge other people. They think they found a soulmate. This girl is terrific. She's beautiful. She's everything you could want. They agree on everything. You know, they know everything, and she did something once that she perhaps she forgot, or she doesn't think it makes any difference, and then it's a disaster. And what can you say? There is no God. There is nobody to ensure that innocent people can't have bad things happen to them. All you can do is take all the rational precautions you can, and if we had a free country, leave scientists free, and they would be able to protect us from these and whatever other diseases are going to come up. Well, on that negative note, let's stop for today.